I thought I'd take a little bit of digression here to discuss some concerns raised by our church friends about separation of families. And I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government, because God has ordained the government for his purposes.
Tell me, where could I go but to the Lord?
That was Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and in case you didn't hear the kind of swallowed last bit of his comments from last week in response to evangelical criticism of the administration's enforcement policies along the border, he was quoting Bible scripture to, quote, obey the laws of the government because God has ordained the government for his purposes. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Podcast Editor's Roundtable edition on Monday here. I am Matt Welch, joined as per usual with my esteemed colleagues, Catherine Mangy Ward, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. Good morning, you all.
Good morning, Matt.
Hey.
That's nicely chipper and in a short period of time. So it seems as though this weekend over Father's Day, we really got subsumed with a topic that we've talked about in this podcast at least three or four times, which is the aforementioned administration's new enforcement policies about separating children from their parents or guardians along the border, asylum seekers who are coming to this country. It's something like 2,000 kids, or about 50 a day, have been separated from their parents, sometimes using the, we're just going to take them to go take a shower or a bath justification along the way.
Yeah, really.
That's
excellent,
just a little
history
bit
of that one.
Ominous. We've got First Ladies, current and former, Laura Welch Bush, came out with a widely penned op-ed in today's Washington Post decrying this category. Melania Trump issued a statement saying this is bad. The president of the United States has been tweeting all morning a lot of commentary and sometimes non sequiturs about MS-13 and immigration crime in Germany, kind of exaggerating that. So in this large mess, in a very emotional time, Catherine, starting with you, is it possible to avoid the conclusion that the president of the United States right now is using 2-year-olds as kind of hostage in a legislative negotiation over immigration reform?
He's definitely doing that because members of his administration explicitly said they were going to do that. That's how we know. And I think this idea that, what I'm seeing in my Twitter feeds is just this incredible amount of back and forth on the appropriate level of whataboutism. In some ways, it is an interesting conversation, right? Like, people are reacting differently to a thing that is not identical to what happened under Obama, but is certainly comparable to what happened to many individual families under Obama. And, the debate over our collective obligation to note those parallels in the appropriate venues is sort of fascinating. At the same time, that's all a garbage distraction from the fact that we are using 2-year-olds separated from their families to score political points.
Yes, I think the appropriate question is, what about the children and their parents?
Wow. Suderman, holding down the...
Did you just, for the children, within the first five minutes?
Sincered for the children. And you know what? He's not wrong.
He's not wrong. Nick, you've got a great post out already this morning talking about that. And one of the lines in there was about how sort of astonishingly or weirdly this series of events hasn't really put a dent into President Trump's approval ratings. Just zeroing in on that, there's been a lot of commentary from Republicans and Democrats alike of, this is not who we are, which is, of course, always an aspirational statement as much as anything else. But my dark-hearted question to you is this maybe kind of who we are at long last?
Yeah. I mean, it clearly is who we are, because there is legislation afoot that could resolve this particular issue. And I think it's really important to understand what we're talking about here, because these are people who are crossing the border into the country illegally with minor children. And then they are either, you know, they're being arrested and they're being treated. Trump has discretion to either treat this as a misdemeanor or as a more serious crime. As president and enforcing the laws, he has the discretion to either keep families together for at least the first several days or a couple of weeks, 20 days, or separate them. There's a lot of things that he is choosing to inflame the situation in the way that he's doing. They were talking about doing it a year ago, and at that point, the pushback was strong enough where they decided not to separate families coming in this situation. So there's no question Trump, one of the things that is particularly frustrating about all of this is that he keeps saying, this is a horrible law, but I'm forced to enforce it, and it's the Democrats' fault, or the Democrats need to fix it. And all of that is basically a lie, or a series of lies. Is it who we are? Yeah, because our government is doing this, you know. Is it or
is and government it, is the word for things we do together?
Yeah, well, and you know, and Trump's approval ratings are going up. That could be also because, you know, people don't view everything he does just because of, you know, what's newest in the news cycle or how reporters and media people care about it. So, you know, people were generally impressed by the North Korea stuff, whatever else we want to say about it and other things. The economy is doing well, et cetera. He still has terrible approval ratings. I think that the larger issue, and this is, again, you know, you want to fix this particular situation because it is shocking, even if the numbers are in the scale of, you know, humanity very small. As you were talking about, Matt, we're talking about dozens a day crossing the border. We're talking about a couple of thousand people overall who have been kind of affected by this. But, you know, I mean, if we're as long as Jeff Sessions is, you know, slinging Bible verses and whatnot, it's true that, you know, what we do for the least among us, you know, is an indicator of who we are as a country. I really think, and I realize I'm a total broken record on this, but it's Congress that is really the malefactor here. It really, really, really is. And, you know, George Bush tried to do a comprehensive immigration reform. A bipartisan group of Democrats and Republicans tried to do it. Barack Obama half-heartedly signed on to stuff. We have not had, it's not the president's fault, a president's fault, that we have shitty immigration laws or that we don't have immigration reform. It is squarely with Congress. And you'll note, nobody is talking about how to fix this other than how to use this particular moment for political advantage in a very short term, you know, read through the midterms kind of.
It's not just Congress's fault in some ways, though they certainly deserve an awful lot of blame. It's the fault of voters who seem to think that this is a pretty good policy in many cases, not necessarily a majority, but certainly a lot of Republicans do. This is the fault of voters who keep electing Republicans to Congress who block reforms. It's the fault of voters who elected Donald Trump to be president who put this policy in place.
But Democrats block reform, too. 2014, and in 2007, you know, immigration reform failed because of a significant number of Democrats who controlled the Senate. I agree with you, Peter, but that's also assuming that voters vote on a single issue, which they wouldn't have known. I mean, you know, there's no question Trump's entire presidential platform, campaign, and announcement, which happened like a year ago to the day or within a couple of days, was, you know, he immediately pivoted from political correctness to talk about how Mexicans were rapists and drug dealers and disease carriers and all of that. And that was the cornerstone of his campaign. But most people don't care about immigration, and that's not a bad thing. It's because most people are okay with immigration, and most people don't get all that hot and bothered about illegal immigrants, much less legal immigrants. And when I say it's Congress's fault, you know, it is the Republican Party at this point is trying to destroy or massively reduce legal immigration. And I'm willing to say it's my fault as a voter, but I've never voted for somebody who's anti-immigrant. I can't vote against or for somebody like Tom Cotton or Senator Perdue, who is behind those laws. So I agree with you, but it's also that would be like saying every time a school shooting happens, every time something happens to abortion rights, that all voters should share our idea that, you know, X, Y, or Z issue, which generally is a very, you know, very, very few voters make that their top priority. You know, all voters' priorities should be our
Catherine,
priorities.
There's Ben Sasse, senator from either Nebraska or Kansas. I lack the confidence to say that.
Nebraska.
Because I'll get it wrong. It's kind of like Jim Epstein's last name or Zach Weissmuller's at this point. But he had a Facebook post, I think, this morning, and he's lighting up his Twitter feed, in which he comes to the conclusion that the current policy as enforced by the Trump administration is wicked, his words. But along the way, he gets into a bunch of stuff about how, for sure, the asylum process. And to be clear, this is what we're kind of talking about here. Like we're changing how we deal with people who are coming to the country and claiming asylum. And part of that, too, just another sidebar, is that reportedly a lot of people who've been going to normal border entry points and saying, hey, I'd like to apply for asylum, are being sort of pushed back. It's a no, 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 you can't do it here. And this is sort of pushing them to illegal entry there, too. But Catherine, drilling down into the narrow question here from Sasse is that the quote unquote catch and release program from before, or like a method of enforcement of it from before on asylum seekers, saying that after they come in and apply for asylum, we can't hold them forever, so we release them out into society at large, that is a terrible thing. And this is this was an overreaction to an existing terrible thing. Is catch and release a bad way to deal with people who are coming to this country applying for asylum?
I think the problem is the artificial categories that we're trying to work in here. And, you know, asylum seeking is, you know, many people claim asylum, and the definition of the legitimate causes for being allowed to claim asylum is necessarily like soft and open to interpretation. And the reason that people are attempting to claim asylum is because it's for many people, it is the only even theoretically plausible road into our country in a legal context, because all the other roads are so convoluted, so difficult to get on and take so long. Asylum, of course, also takes a long time to process. But I think the underlying problem is that we generated a bunch of fake categories, and then we tried to jam people, or people tried to jam themselves into the fake categories, and we are ascribing moral worth that's different to the different categories. So we say, well, if you're an asylum seeker, you're a victim and it's not your fault and you came here because you were suffering at home. If you're an illegal alien or an illegal immigrant or a border jumper, then you're bad. As if wanting to come here for economic reasons or for personal reasons is somehow a totally different moral landscape than wanting to come here because you were being, you know, politically persecuted at home or you feared for your life. They're not different. They're not different. People immigrate for mixes of these reasons all the time. And it's, you know, Republicans in particular who want to try and have it both ways, who want to say, no, I'm in favor of legal immigration, but it's, you know, these lawbreakers that I'm against. That distinction is artificial. So I do think the catch and release thing is part of this, but I think mostly those type of policies are a result of our attempt to delicately parse why people want to come here, when instead we should basically just say, if you want to come here, if you don't have a record at home, if you clearly don't have ill intent coming in, just come in. It doesn't matter whether it's asylum or immigration or whatever.
That is why that kind of immigration policy has not been able to get a serious vote.
And that was, for, and I think, you know, it's important to point out that was our immigration policy for much of the country's early history, right? Until the 20s, basically, you didn't have to prove that someone was trying to kill you at home to be allowed to come in. You could just say, I'm here. I want to work.
As long as you were an Asian, essentially, which was a broad category. But yeah.
Well, we did start discriminating against Asians first. Oh, do you hear this transition
soon,
coming,
though,
Matt? Are you ready for this transition?
Bet this one around a little bit more.
All right. We'll talk about
I agree with this, this is foreshadowing, I think.
More Asians to come. But we started discriminating against Asians first. But even, you know, before that, it was a very, very open system, and having to, you know, write your essay about why you want to come here was not the reason that you got in.
this is the other thing that is staggering. And, you know, I mean, you, just from a perspective of sheer political theater, you really do have to kind of give it to Trump. We're talking, you know, in this instance with these, you know, horrible images coming out of, you know, people. I mean, like, you know, whenever you see people in America, regardless, even if they're prisoners, you know, even if they're on fucking death row, you know, sleeping in like Mylar blankets and stuff like that, you know, something just has gone wrong. But we're talking about maybe 4,000 people. It's about 2,000 kids and about 2,000 adults that are trapped in the, you know, this kind of miasma that we're talking about right now. And, you know, we're talking about a country, you know, of, you know, well over 300 million people. We are talking about immigration flows that are in the millions each year. And this isn't to take away from the pain of that, but this is the type of thing, and Trump is brilliant at, like, why are we talking about this? This is not, we need to be focused on larger questions about immigration policy that would make this either go away or be easier to deal with. But to the extent, and I almost like, I feel complicit, Matt, you know, or to Peter's question about, like, you know, it's up to the voters. It's, I almost feel complicit in extending the policy by talking about, you know, these people at the border right now, because it's so screwed up. And like, until we can have a discussion about immigration, that is actually about immigration policy and not simply about these particular cases. I mean, this would be like determining, I guess maybe for libertarians, and I saw way too many people on Twitter claiming to be libertarian over the weekend who were like, if you, you know, like, I sympathize with these people, but, you know, the rule of law is the rule of law. Or like, if you don't want your family separated, don't come here, you know, illegally, blah, blah, blah. But this would be like debating all gun control should be debated only in the context of the latest school shooting.
Which is basically how we debate gun control. So actually, that's accurate. Though.
No, but it isn't. Because like for all of the gun control stuff that has happened, you know, or rather all of the mass shootings that have happened, there has been essentially no movement on gun control policy because gun control policy has been hashed out at both the state level and then, you know, primarily through the courts at the federal level or at the national level over a period of decades. And there was actual engagement and discussion on a lot of these laws. I mean, we passed a assault weapons ban that didn't do anything and then was not renewed and nothing happened, et cetera. I mean, like, we have not had that conversation.
I wonder,
we were incapable of having that conversation.
So, Nick, just a quick question on that, though, is that didn't we try, maybe not we as a the four of us or we even as a nation, but Congress try to have that conversation back when they were trying to do comprehensive immigration reform? And what Republicans found out was that when they even started to have that conversation, their voters revolted. And so my worry or my question to you or for all of us is, I think we're all pretty close to on the same page when it comes to what we think sort of the broad immigration policy of the United States should be. It's not really clear. It seems actually quite likely to me that most Americans would not agree with us, and certainly that a significant core of the Republican Party base voters would not agree with us in a way that basically makes that sort of that makes movement on this policy on immigration thinking generally somewhat impossible.
Yeah, I agree.
I would add, to that, Peter, just to step on Nick's tongue.
Yeah.
Non-recreationally this time, actually some of the people who are enforcing these policies are the ones who've been having the conversation the longest. Jeff Sessions has spent more time and energy talking about immigration in the United States Senate, maybe than anyone in the 21st century, because he was the one who was always opposed to immigration reform. And he would come out and he would quote the Center for Immigration Studies. And what he would say about immigration is that these people are disproportionately sucking up our welfare, which they are not, that they are disproportionately criminal, which they are not. Donald Trump said this morning, like, we can't have immigration like Europe, like, always conflating European refugee intake among, you know, people from war-torn majority Muslim states with us having Mexican dishwashers come in over the border, which doesn't even really happen as much anymore. So the conversation has been happening. by people who say things that are objectively untrue and are conflating things that aren't so. So that points to a bit of a quandary in all of this. We can have a great conversation, and yet we can't get close to sort of agreeing on the basics of what's in front of our nose. And now we have an administration that is that reinforces those wrong facts constantly, and also is in their enforcement choices providing some kind of almost cathartic, finally, we're going to do those things that we've always either promised or claimed that there has been a bipartisan elite globalist conspiracy preventing us from doing. And so before we leave the topic, maybe I'll just throw this to Nick. Could there be some kind of boomerang effect on this? Whereas, okay, this is what Jeff Sessions has always wanted and the CIS and other people have always wanted to do. Here's what that looks like. Here's what that looks like. And that maybe the pendulum will swing in the opposite direction when people are shocked to discover what their kind of fantasies look like in practice.
Yeah, I agree, Matt, that I hope that that happens because, you know, one of the along with, you know, I have three or four hobby horses, I suppose, that I ride all the time. And one of them is that Congress is always the problem. If we're talking about anything coming out of D.C., Congress is the problem. The other thing is that, as you were saying, Matt, you know, like when you finally see what the policy looks like, you're like, holy shit, I didn't mean that. And there will be a pendulum swing against it. You know, another hobby horse I have is, you know, that Trump is demystifying the executive branch in a way more fully and kind of more brutally, but also more artfully than Barack Obama or George Bush did when they consistently lied. I mean, like when you have Bush say, I believe in free market capitalism, and that's why I'm going to suspend it in order to say it. Or when Barack Obama says, I want the most transparent administration in, you know, in the world, except for Edward Snowden. No, what I meant to say is that I want to talk about state surveillance and a bunch of other lies, you know, and hidden facts. Trump, at every day, he is showing us what an impulse control challenged chief executive is like, and he takes the GOP platform that he was elected on, and he didn't do anything that was that different than, you know, what they wanted. He's showing us what it really looks like, and it's up to us to recognize that and then to move into a different space. Because I hope, you know, that people will look at this and say, you know what, not only is this particular thing fucked up, like we could take 4,000 of, like, you know, the best Soviet agents circa 1976, and bring them into the country and not collapse. We can certainly take a bunch of Guatemalan women and kids and, like, get on with our lives. And more than that, we need to actually think about an immigration flow. And Matt, I think you've always talked about how, like, we should be talking about illegal immigration or immigration, you know, as a problem with prohibition, not a problem about morality or this or that. Like, you know, if you legalize something that consenting adults and people want to do, you're going to get black markets, and black markets are always bad. I hopefully that will be the discussion.
I think that
comes
some of this can be wrapped in the broader, more general rubric of that there is a large audience, particularly, but definitely not only among the Republican Party. There's a huge bits in the Democratic Party, too, that is against what they perceived as the consensus of the elite. And they have a lot of things that they can point to that are elite failures, most notably in this century, obviously, the Iraq war, the reaction to 9/11, the reaction, the financial crisis itself, and then the reaction to it. There's a lot of stuff. And I think that they put as part of that the kind of soft bipartisan consensus in Washington about what the immigration reform should look like. And they say, it's another elite plot, like the Euro or something. And so we're on the other side. And this, not Asians, is my transition to the Harvard elite, the most elite school this side of Yale, according to Catherine Mangu Ward, burst into flames last week when an ongoing lawsuit that we've written a lot about, Robbie Suave, Reason has written about, came out with some discovery documents finding that Harvard in monkeying with its admissions in such a way that produces a better, from its point of view, diversity headcount, has been using subjective personality demerits on all the damn Asians because there's too many Asians to come in, and it's their way of doing it. Catherine, as someone who went to Harvard, can you sort of...
Oh, God, Matt, did you? Are you trolling her?
Yeah, of course he is.
I wake up
every day, fucking day.
Matt is the Stephen Miller of Catherine Mangu Ward.
God, oh, yeah. That is the deepest truth that's ever been spoken. Go ahead, Matt. Ask your question.
I absolutely am. I avoid most college admission stuff and affirmative action stuff like a plague, just because it's too much to think about and I'm not very college focused. What does this is this the thing? Is this the wedge that finally blows this stuff up? It feels like there's been an incredibly to go back to that word, cathartic reaction among at least the Asian Americans that I follow of like, oh man, that's messed up. This one, that's too much. We've been suffering in silence for long enough. But when you start like counting us down because our subjective personality demerits, you've gone a bridge too far. Is this the thing that's going to finally blow up affirmative action?
No. And here's why. Because this is exactly, precisely what happened with Jews at elite schools in the 20s and 30s. So the reason that we do college admissions the way we do, this sort of thing, which I think almost anyone who's ever applied to college on some level has detected that it's bullshit, right? Like you fill out this big dumb form and like it's like, what's your favorite animal and color and like whatever the fuck, I don't know, like it's been a while since I applied to college, but they ask you like so many questions. The interview process,
and your response was like, I don't like animals.
Yeah. And then they let me in.
Kill all the animals.
The interview process, which is done by alumni scattered around the country based on like no standards as far as we can tell, like the whole thing feels like bullshit. And the reason that it does is because it is bullshit that was explicitly crafted in the early mid 20th century because colleges had too many Jews. They were opening up a kind of meritocracy. They were using test scores
from
and
their
lo
perspective.
And behold, right, thank you, Peter. And lo and behold, a bunch of Jews got into really top schools because, I don't know, Jews are smart or something. But the powers that be thought like, oh, this isn't right. We have a magical vision in our head of what the appropriate ethnic balance of our institutions should be. We're going to figure out how to enforce that without quite saying that's what we're doing. And that's what college admissions are today.
And I want to point out to, I think, Peter, who went to a directional state university or graduated from a directional state university in Florida, Matt, who went to a UC school, and myself, who has 3 degrees from 3 different state schools, never been interviewed as a condition of going to an undergraduate
college. But
that's
just, it's like when you have a lot of resources.
So you're already talking about an elite.
Right. We're talking about elite schools. When you have a lot of resources and you have a specific outcome that you want,
elite schools,
you can engineer that outcome. And that's what's happening here again. Yeah.
But
and I think,
wait, why is that a problem? Why is that a problem? Or is it a problem because this is kind of like, and here I want to be a libertarian troll, because I think it was like last week or 2 weeks ago we were talking about, well, you know what, if, you know, some fucking douchebag cake baker wants to cite Jeff Sessions citing scripture to say, I don't want to bake a cake for gay people. I don't even want to serve gay people. And don't get me started on the Jews or the blacks. That should be their right.
Yep. And likewise,
why is that? Is the problem here that Harvard isn't coming out publicly and saying, you know what, we just don't want Asians, whatever that means. And I'm assuming it's mostly South Asian Indians and Chinese, just because that's where the numbers are. But is it the problem that they're being hypocritical about it, or is it the policy itself?
So obviously, they're private institutions. They can do what they want. And
But is it a good policy?
Oh, my
policy?
God, dude, let me answer your question, and I will. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for two reasons. First is the hypocrisy angle, right? Like, this is an elaborate process which millions of people every year, millions of 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds invest a huge amount in, and they are being told the game is to be played one way, and the game is rigged, and that matters. We don't like rigged games in our society, and particularly not at institutions that, even if they are, I would say, of diminishing importance, elite schools occupy a large place in the cultural imagination, and, you know, I think this ongoing, you know, and there's also just a massive bureaucracy built up around essentially obfuscating how these schools wind up with the ethnic and gender and race balance that they have.
It's sports team balance.
Lot of people have a lot at stake, and it's fair to say, you know, we want to know how this is really functioning. And I think it's you know, in New York, they're recently doing something very similar. De Blasio has announced that he wants to change the way admission to test schools work. New York's test schools are essentially Ivy League high schools. Like, they're similarly elite and insane. One thing that I found very interesting is De Blasio keeps saying the distinction between who does and doesn't get into these schools is people who have access to test prep or other economic advantages. Because we have all these stereotypes about Asians as wealthy, that argument works. But in fact, 60% of the kids at the three top test schools are eligible for free or reduced price lunch in New York. So it's layers of ethnic stereotypes, racism, and you know, hypocrisy, plus a certain amount of fraud, depending on how the question is framed. So I do think it matters, and I think we don't want to repeat the mistakes of anti-Semitism of the 20s and 30s with America's Asians today.
Peter, you're from Florida. That's an anti-Semitic state. What about the just
also anti-Asian?
They have Asians in Florida. What about just the notion that you know, Harvard takes government money, and so does most elite, even private education.
All schools, public or private.
Nearly all schools, period. It's very, very small number of schools. I don't have the number in front of me, but I've seen
there are a number of people out there who focus on this issue quite a lot and say, look, we're just this is the argument kind of against affirmative action writ large, but that we are in trying to cover up the sort of original sin of American governance. We're following up on it. We're creating a new version of it by constantly judging people by their belonging to groups, and that in itself is a wrong thing. That we should be focusing on our energies to dismantle, so we can get back to something akin to a more true meritocracy, or at least individualism based system. What say you, Peter Student?
I think that if you accept...
Son of a college professor.
Son of a college professor, also grandson of a college professor.
Wow, see?
So it's...
Kind of a failure.
You know, this is my genetic inheritance, and I can't avoid it. What I basically think is that if you give the state a role in funding your institution, then you necessarily, inevitably... set up a situation in which the state is going to want to start monkeying with how you do business. You can head it off for a while. Perhaps you can reduce that effect over time. Perhaps you can make arguments that, well, we should be able to take their money and then do what we want with it. But ultimately, that's just not how it works. But I also think that the other kind of financial effect that we need to be talking about here is our big donors. And so if you actually look at the report that came out that BuzzFeed reported on, what they said was the report that came out was initially supposed to show that Harvard didn't discriminate. And then they decided not to release it until this court case brought it to the public. They decided not to release it because what it would show was that while they did give a tip, a bonus basically, to low-income students, they gave larger tips to students who were there for sports and students who were children of alumni. And so my kind of suspicion, my prediction, although I don't quite want to go that far, but what I expect from this is that we are very quickly going to see the end, or at least a significant reduction, to sports-based tips, because that's pretty easy for Ivy League schools. And then the really big fight that we are going to be gearing up for is not just about how we treat Asians or other races or ethnic groups, but about how we treat children of alumni, because that's the information that Harvard wants to protect the most. And that is... it's just huge for them financially, and it is huge for them institutionally. And there will be a gigantic fight about how they're going to treat children and relatives of alumni and big donors.
Nick,
I mean, my school explicitly reached out to me when my children started, you know, preschool.
When your children were in your womb.
Literally, I, you know, not as part of some kind of explicit quid pro quo, but like pretty darn close. I started getting hit up as soon as it was clear that I had spawned. Hey, double Yale family. You're going to want your kids to go here, right? So here's how you can easily give. Here's a bunch of ways to set up your giving. You can set up your giving so that you commit now to give batshit amounts of money over the next two decades to be totally sure your children will get in. That is the deal. People understand that to be the deal. And it's going to be like, it's kind of like with Social Security or something where people are like, I paid in, goddammit. I have rights. And it's like, you know what? Actually, you don't. They could be revoked at any time, but no one's going to be
Nick, does Rutgers have legacies?
You know what? They don't. And I was surprised because most state schools, it's not just private schools, most state schools have some kind of legacy program. Some of them have gotten rid of them, but they advertise it. And I'm speaking from Oxford, Ohio, where my ex-wife was a full professor after many years.
But state schools have large attendance and are comparatively very
What I'm saying is that even state-assisted schools, and it's also worth pointing out, by the way, that most certainly all the Research One schools and PhD granting institutions at the state level typically get less than 15% and often less than 10% of their operating budget from state funds. So, you know, they could conceivably be getting less public money when you factor in research grants, et cetera, than a lot of private institutions. What I was getting at, Peter, is simply that most institutions, whether they are public or private, have all kinds of legacy programs and ins for different groups. I agree with you. Looking at this, there was a great book that came out in 2005 by Daniel Golden called The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into College, into Elite Schools, and Who Gets Left Out, or something like that. And it's a really good description of a lot of different level types of schools, public, private, elite, not so elite, et cetera. As Catherine, as your kids get closer to college, you'll start reading these as well as like Andy Ferguson's Crazy You. Terrifying books, great books to read. What I was going to say in all of this, Matt, to go with the demystification route, again, like what this type of stuff is doing also, it is demystifying a bunch of processes that have always been shrouded in mystery. And it's worth us like looking at this. I for one, you know, I find the Harvard policy both understandable and wrongheaded as it comes to Asians, particularly because like if you're not taking into account, you know, what you mean by Asians, that's like talking about like new worlders or something. It covers so many vastly different people at different levels of education and income and experience and all of that. It's just insane. I don't care about Harvard, and I don't, you know, I could give two shits about it. But I do like the idea that we're you know, opening up the hood and looking at how elite schools, how non-elite schools work. We're looking, because of the cost of education, we're looking at whether or not it's worth it. There is not very good data. My sister, who is a dean at Notre Dame, tells me there's not even very good data that people at elite schools, much less non-elite schools, learn very much in 4 years. People are still trying to kind of like really lock that down in a meaningful way, and certainly in any way that justifies the immense cost of this stuff. We are going through a long period across the board where many of our institutions that we've inherited for, you know, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years are really kind of breaking down. They're not really serving our needs anymore. And more people are saying, you know, why the fuck are we going through all of this? Or what's going on here? And the results are, you know, aren't pretty, but I think they're necessary and it's kind of interesting.
But the advantage of the Ivy League schools, I mean, I think even, well, Catherine, you know, you can either confirm whether this is understood explicitly or implicitly.
I can neither confirm nor deny whatever
I'm sorry,
you're about to say.
You've got the ALNDA, right?
Yeah, look at you, Catherine. Your parents went to Yale, or you know, your parents paid for you to go to Yale, or you went to Yale, and now you're in a podcast with a Rutgers grad.
It's more of an excellent
good job, Catherine. That shows good life choices, at least maybe on our part. Actually, I don't know about yours, but the advantage isn't that you get a better education and just in the sense that you learn more. I mean, a little bit, right? You have some access to really interesting professors, maybe. But the real advantage of going to an Ivy League school is that it is a sort of breeding ground for social connection with other literally everybody. But like it is a place for social connection that gives you a leg up in the world of business, in the professional and cultural and social world that comes after that.
Peter,
and
so
that
is where proving ground, right?
And so that's where people both meet the other people, and it's also how they learn how to behave around those other people and what the expectations are.
And what happens when you put your thumb on the scale on racial quotas is that in this important breeding ground where America's elites are learning how to behave, they are learning weird subvariant of racism. They are learning to expect that Asians will be more competent, particularly in math and science. They are learning to expect that Blacks and Latinos will struggle and be less competent. And that's because of the way that this admissions pools are sorted. And I actually think that's really dangerous to sort of double down on a bunch of cultural stereotypes in this like super rarefied atmosphere. Because of someone's vague idea about what the quote unquote correct racial balance
is. I agree.
It's not good.
So last year, Richard Reeves of Brookings wrote a book called Dream Hoarders, and he basically argued that it's incorrect to look at the top 1% or 0.1% of the wealthy in the United States. Instead, we should be looking at the top 10 or 20% and not really looking at what they do for themselves, but instead how they transfer their privilege and their wealth to children. And that's a huge part of what's at stake here. This is not, you know, sort of the argument about who gets into Harvard is not an argument that most Americans have a really huge personal stake in, but it is one that the sort of most powerful and sort of upper middle to upper lower upper class has a huge stake in, because it is about their children. And if you live in a place like Washington, D.C. or New York City or other similar sorts of cities, you now see these arguments playing out at the elementary school level, where I know parents, again, Catherine may be able to speak to this better than me, who are like obsessed, who have to spend years sort of on waiting lists and like getting their kids into exclusive elementary prep schools that sort of put them on the line to getting into the right Ivy eventually. And so, you know, this is in large part about elite parents attempting to protect and preserve their own privilege
and
for
I
their
think
kids.
If I may, a couple of things. First off, the studies that have attempted to find a financial premium for attending an Ivy League school go begging for data. And for instance, 15 years ago, Princeton tried to, you know, quantify the value of going to an Ivy League school rather than going to a state school. And they did a study where they looked at people who were accepted to Penn and to Penn State. And then they tracked what happened to them. 10 years out, there was no difference. If you got accepted, what was key in this case, and other studies have confirmed this general finding, what was key is if you could get into an Ivy League school, you were going to do as well as if you went there while spending a lot less money. There were stronger effects for attending more elite schools if you were Black, and a little bit less so, but still one if you were Latino, which suggests, Peter, that the social network effect is there somewhat. Having said that, part of what I think Reeves is about, too, because, and this is really important, that intergenerational mobility has not changed much. This is what, you know, one of the things that Scott Winship talks about endlessly, and nobody actually challenges his data going back to the 70s. You know, people still move up and down income quintiles, you know, in the same rates that they did. We can argue that they're lower than they should be. You know, I would be that, and that not enough people fall from the top towards the bottom. But, you know, that hasn't changed. And what I think we're having is a conversation where elite people are doing kind of what the pigeons in various B.F. Skinner experiments would do, is they would engage in superstitious behavior and they would do the last thing they did, i.e. go to an elite school or get their kids into elite grammar schools and then high schools and then colleges, because they figure that's the ticket to success. They can do that. And it's not going to change the fact that, you know, just as the top companies in America over 50 and 100 years change and vanish and disappear, so too do the people who are in the top income, you know, reaches and the lower income reaches. And I think it's worth having that discussion with data and outside of the bubble, because this is something that people in New York, Boston, San Francisco, D.C., et cetera, talk about. it doesn't really map very well onto the real world. And as a final point, Peter, you were right that, you know, the Ivies essentially haven't increased the supply of slots, you know, over, you know, at least since the early 70s when they went co-ed. What has happened, though, is that a bunch of other schools, and this includes what are now considered top tier schools, but were not in the 70s, like NYU or Duke, are now extremely good schools. Notre Dame is tougher to get into than a bunch of Ivy League schools. Dartmouth is it doesn't even get the highest rating from a couple of university accrediting boards anymore because other schools have surpassed it. There is now a vast industry of private colleges that went from being kind of mediocre finishing schools for dummies to being absolutely as good or better than any school anywhere you're going to find in America. Public schools have all, USC and Notre Dame are the two great turnaround football schools where they're now incredibly hard to get into because they're elite institutions. And then every public university, in order to keep the best people there, they've created honors colleges. They've created all sorts of varied experiences that are tremendous. So, I mean, one of the, you know, we can argue that there's too much supply of higher education. What I don't think we can really, and this, I guess, goes against the kind of PC backlash and Jordan Peterson and postmodern critics and all, you know, critics of postmodernism. The availability and range of great college experiences at every price point is just fucking awesome. And that's a good thing.
So what you're saying is, even if I'd gone to Harvard,
you would still
I'd
be
still
in
be
this
here
fucking
in
conversation.
This podcast
yes,
booth.
Yes, that is, the odds are very
recording
good.
Recording the Reason Editors podcast on a Monday.
Yep. I would just like to point out,
all your timelines converge right here.
For Catherine's sake, who's been suffering through my bad metaphors for a large portion of her adult career, like Nick, I did not ever get interviewed for any part of the college process. And the only thing that came close to it was my entrance essay. And unlike most things that I wrote, including last week, I actually remember at least the lead of my entrance essay, Catherine. And it was something along the lines of asking a 17-year-old to evaluate and sort of summarize and point forward from his life at that stage in his life is like asking an outdoor mud sculptor to evaluate his half-finished work in the rain.
Wow.
In that, the rain, Catherine.
That's actually a good metaphor. That, like, it's consistent.
I mean, at least it's internally consistent, which I do appreciate. True story, my Princeton interview featured me sitting in a cafe with a dude who then asked me if I had ever done anything truly remarkable.
Wow. And you were like,
I said no.
And this was false. You were in the band.
Were you playing him like, okay, it's true? No.
You were the drum
because
major.
I only won a Nobel Prize.
First of all, fuck all that. You know, I truly was like, well, like what? Give me some examples. And he was like, I don't know, save someone from drowning. And I was like, nope. I've been very lucky.
Have
in
you
my
ever
life.
Drowned anyone?
I got
that would
nothing.
Count too.
I did not get
who
into
here,
Princeton.
Who here lied like a rug on their college entrance about like all the volunteer work you did at the hospital?
None.
True story. I also wrote a little extra essay on my college application essays about how I thought volunteer work was immoral.
Oh,
jeez. Yeah. Yep.
Editor of Reason Magazine, folks. I did not lie on my college admission essay thing. I can't remember whether I filed one or sent it in on time or anything at all. I did, however, lie in hopes of getting into a preschool. At my parents' instruction, I told the cutoff date, the age cutoff date, was
October
like
birthdays.
3 days
it's
before
hard.
Mine. And so they were like, Peter, give a birthday that's 10 days before your birthday
so that
you could get into this sort of like, not elite, but definitely sort of like advanced preschool
Jordan
thing.
Peterson.
For listeners who do not know, Peter and I are birthday twins. We have the same birthday. And my mom dealt with this problem by like just showing up with me and being like, you'll take her.
Wow.
Like you have to take her. She needs to start kindergarten. She needs to get the hell out of my house. So I somehow got into kindergarten at age 4 because just like, you'll take her.
I ended up in a Montessori
Peter,
school.
You started
I think
college.
Peter just exposed the lies of academia.
Peter, you started at a religious college, right? A Christian college. What, you know, did they, I mean, they work to kind of assure a good mix, right? I mean, like a kind of demographic mix that will do well there, do you figure? pretty heavily, or?
I don't think I could speak to what they worked to or not. They definitely had something like either a scholarship. I believe it was a scholarship. It might have been sort of subsidized loans for minority students, because at a small liberal arts school in the South, where you have to attest to your faith and attend chapel three times a week, minority students were not a big part of their applicant pool.
Let's pivot our final pivot here and get to, because I want to be able to talk at least about my end here a little bit, of our what we have been consuming: books, TVs, in Peter's case, video games, 3D virtual reality, porn, etc. Peter, do you want to start off what you have been consuming lately and share it with the audience?
Yeah, I haven't played a video game in a couple of weeks, but I did finish reading Jennifer Egan's novel Manhattan Beach. Jennifer Egan is a novelist based in New York who I've been checking out over the course of the year. She's written the Pulitzer Prize winner, Visit from the Goon Squad, also a sort of fascinating, pulpy metafiction book called The Keep, which I really recommend. Manhattan Beach is her first novel, or is somewhat unusual for her. I'm not sure actually it's her first, because I haven't read all of her books. Somewhat unusual in that it is relatively traditionally structured. There's some character and time jumping, but it's basically a kind of melodramatic, pulpy, but also really sort of smart and literary historical novel that takes place around World War II, in particular at the docks and the shipbuilding facilities in Manhattan and Brooklyn. It's really just a beautifully written and emotionally adept and smart novel about what it was like to live at that time and to live in that world, and also in particular to be a young woman trying to make her way through a world that is interestingly, though not always menacingly, controlled by men.
Nick, what do you got?
I finished over the past week or so, I finished The Americans, which I had, along with Meredith Bragg and Jim Epstein and Mark McDaniel, we interviewed the creator and the main producer of the show before its final season started. The Americans, which is about a couple of undercover Soviet agents posing as travel agents in 1980s Northern Virginia and D.C. The final season is so fantastic. It's available on the FX app or, you know, in various on-demand configurations on cable systems and whatnot. I think that series overall may be like it is certainly one of the greatest artistic accomplishments of, you know, the past 30 years, as far as I'm concerned. Just a brilliant meditation, both. And Peter wrote about it at the site as well after the finale, and I suspect shares my high rating of it.
I believe it has taken the place of The Wire as my favorite television series ever.
And what I was going to say is that it is about a marriage that was forced on people, and then like how these two adults grow while they have the most fucked up possible career under the most bizarre circumstances. But even more profoundly than that, what I realized at the end is that we have enough distance from the Cold War now to actually start engaging deeper issues and more kind of nuanced and sophisticated observations. And one of the things that was fascinating, Joe Weisberg, who is the brother of Jacob Weisberg of Slate and the son of Lois Weisberg, who was made famous in Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point, who are liberal. He was a CIA agent and he was a Cold Warrior. But what he ultimately came to in the series, which I think is deeply moving, is that he creates a moral equivalency, not between the two systems of government or of population control, but among individual actors in that. And it's, you know, I'm into the Cold War. I was in many ways a child of the Cold War, certainly the last gasp of it. An ardent capitalist. I hate communism. And this made me, you know, really think long and hard actually about what it was like to grow up both under a communist system as well as a Cold War capitalist system. Just really beautiful, moving, profound.
Catherine, what have you?
I watched Black Panther this weekend because I had not previously, and was super, super distracted in a way that I recognize is entirely my fault and not the fault of the film by the premise of the Wakandan economics. Like, I know. But just like the Wakandanomics of
what was the
idea,
is it vibranium?
The problem,
vibranium,
right,
yeah.
Right, yeah. So they've got the vibranium, but also apparently have the ability to manufacture every object that we have, plus also all other objects that they can envision without any trouble in this small nation. Like, that's not how it works. That was upsetting to me, but I took a deep breath and mostly got over it. I also read this weekend the Crystal Crypt, which is a Philip K. Dick story I had never read before.
What era? Was this Pink Laser era, or was this?
Yeah, so it's Mars and Terra at war, like truth serum sort of deal. It's pretty good. It's kind of psychedelic. It's pretty good. It made me realize I need to finish, like, the Philip K. Dick oeuvre is not something that I've been completionist enough about. So
just wait till you get to Valis.
Oh boy.
I'm not ready. So Wakandanomics and Philip K.
Quick
Dick.
Follow up on Wakanda.
My weekend.
Quick follow up on Wakandanomics, and maybe Peter or anyone else can fill me in. I was confused because the core of Wakanda's, you know, they're rocketed, everything is great, but then they have the sort of outskirts of dusty, impoverished villages, which they also seem to kind of wander back and forth from. So was that sort of like an outer ring of a shield of misery?
That's
so that
where
no one
the
would be
Arabs are, Matt.
Inside?
You're channeling your French experience that they put the Arabs on the outer
yeah,
suburbs.
Yeah, they're in the outer suburbs. No, I mean it's they're somehow they've managed to create a pastoral, simple peoples who also benefit from every technology.
Do you agree Michael,
this fake comic yeah. book based movie is full
but
of
but Michael B. Jordan's character complained. In that, you know, who is raised in America and comes back but is of royal blood and comes back to challenge for the throne of Wakanda, none of his arguments are ever really countered or even acknowledged, much less defeated. I mean, one of the things I loved about that book is that that movie was that I love when the villain has the best speeches. They're right. And nobody even is like, no, you're wrong. And here's why. They just know.
No, I think they're explicit about they explicitly grant that his, you know, while his version is too extreme and militaristic, that the more moderate position of being time to open up to the world is the right one. And then they do in the subsequent movies.
And also, you know, go back to the original housing project and start to react accordingly. So my bit here is because I don't consume hardly any culture and such. After Anthony Bourdain's death, I am now watching his last series, Parts Unknown, from CNN, and only just watched three episodes so far. The Lyon, where my wife is from, Budapest, where we used to live, and Rome, which I think might have been the final episode, or at least one that people talk a lot about. And it's terrific. You're looking at it from a producing point of view, it's like, my God, did they spend a lot of money on this to collect enough B-roll and to gather enough experiences. But it's obvious that when you look at it now, in the wake of his suicide, you can't help but look for his constant references to death. And it's this really interesting exploration so far in all three episodes, and I would bet in the rest of it, where he seems to be haunted by this question of what is the connective tissue that inspires great artists, whether they be chefs or in the Hungarian episode, Vilo Zsigmond, the cinematographer. And he seems to be genuinely kind of haunted by that search. And there's this irony in that, because in the process of doing this, particularly the Rome episode, which is just, I think, a marvelous piece of television. It's this meditation on Mussolini and fascism and such, that in the process of him being visibly haunted by what makes people make great art, he is himself making, I think, what his best art is, which is this kind of exploratory, documentary, food-tethered, but not too tethered journalism here. And I could only hope in the process, regardless of the extent of his depression, that he understood that he was very, very, very good at his art form, even while trying to uncover all of that.
It's really unfair if you go back and read the 1999 New Yorker essay that kind of kickstarted his career as a public figure rather than just as a well-known chef. He is just such a brilliantly talented writer in his, you know, in a maybe not his first, but certainly a very, very early publication, which he didn't even get to until, I believe, his mid or late 40s. I mean, it's just remarkable how excellent and not just sort of clever, but really insightful his
he
prose
wrote
is.
An essay for, I think it was the 20th anniversary maybe of, or 30th anniversary of, like, either Nevermind the Bollocks or the Ramones coming in. It was something about like the summer of punk for Spin magazine, which Peter, that's what you were talking. That's what immediately came to mind. It was this incredibly casual and understated and just brilliant kind of demythologization of kind of grubby New York in the early 70s, both and missing it, but also refusing to pretend that it was anything that it wasn't. I agree. His suicide is, it robs it stopped his suffering, but it certainly robs us of a voice of a writer, which I thought was always more interesting than him speaking, to be quite honest.
I'm extremely worried about who the third is in the trend of three, if we assume that Kate Spade was the other one.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
There's, like, who completes the Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain?
Let's not speculate.
It's got to be an entertainer. I think it's got to be an actor or actress.
Or let's speculate.
We're going to speculate.
It's Johnny Depp. And I'm sorry to predict this, because this
that's a good pick, yeah. I was gonna say Andy Dick, but he's not really on their level. So the Spade story is very sad too.
Yeah, it definitely
I'm
is.
I'm glad that we're ending on
R.I.P. R.I.P. Johnny Depp. There's the end of the Reason podcast.
Grim suicide to end our podcast. Thank you for listening once again. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. Rate and review us while we're there.
We're there. You always say, "While we're
all
there."
There. We're
there.
All there.
We're not there.
Did you learn nothing from Black Panther?
No, I didn't, actually.
Nick, any podcast you want to point to?
I got a
coming
lot of podcasts.
Particularly...
got tons of podcasts. Podcasts coming out of our, out of our wherever.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, thanks, everyone, and stay tuned all week. And goodbye. Yeah.